Everyone knows the Good Samaritan story, or we think we do. A fellow is set upon by thieves who strip him, beat him up, and leave him lying in a ditch, half dead and needing help. First, a priest walks by, then another religious person passes on the other side. Finally, a Samaritan, while traveling, comes near the man and is moved with pity. So the Samaritan goes to him, bathes him and bandages his wounds, carries him on his animal to an inn, spends the night tending to him, and then when he needs to go, leaves money for the man's continued care, promising to come back and pay more if the innkeeper needs it. So familiar is the moniker Good Samaritan that the phrase appears in legal statutes in this country and abroad to describe people who stop to help a person unknown to them. I've seen Jay Leno and David Letterman send reporters out on the street to ask passersby to define the term, and Jimmy Fallon become one. Most people understand the concept as selfless assistance to a stranger, and more than a few know that the character appears in the Bible, which isn't bad, that's good. Even Madison Avenue is in on the game. When I lived and worked in Washington, D.C., Starbucks launched a campaign which relied on the words Good Samaritan in print advertisements, on coupons, and even in a series of stunts staged outside. Here's the scene in 2005. Kenny is cruising down K Street in his black Camry, while drivers honk their horns at him and pedestrians wave their arms excitedly, yelling, "You've got a coffee cup on your car." Kenny doesn't pay attention to them. He's more interested in the man with the cigar in his mouth and the Bluetooth device in his ear who's staring blankly at him, saying nothing. "Look at that," Kenny says, amazed. "He's totally ignoring us." His partner, Carter, rolls down her window to talk to a lady who's pointing at the coffee cup that's stuck to the roof of the car with a magnet and saying, "You left your coffee cup on the roof." "Actually, it's not real," Carter explains, "but thanks for being a good Samaritan." She hands the woman a $5 coupon for Starbucks, and the Camry, with its coffee cup stuck on top, rolls on to more excitement down the road. Do you remember it? It was the first national campaign of Starbucks. It's effective. It's clever. I've actually done that two times with two different cups of coffee on the same car, driven off and had the coffee on the roof. And I've imagined an ad that pictures a Dunkin' Donuts employee reaching over and sending the Starbucks cup flying. On the one hand, the Good Samaritan is a straightforward example for us to follow. Two folks in the story are too busy, or too self-consumed, or perhaps too stuck and scared to stop and help the guy. The Samaritan, however, is willing to engage and draw near the stranger. And that's what makes him good. But what we routinely miss is the radical significance of the Samaritan as hero and the surprise discovery of who it is who's landed in the ditch. You see, if Jesus had wanted to teach only love of the neighbor in distress, it would have sufficed to use the standard folkloric threesome and talk simply of first one person and a second missing the mark and then a third rising to the occasion. And if Jesus wanted to do this and add a jibe against the clerical circles in Jerusalem, it would have been quite enough to have mentioned a priest, a Levite, and let the third character be a Jewish layperson. Most importantly, if Jesus had wanted to inculcate love of one's enemies, it would have been radical enough for his audience of Jewish listeners to have a man stop and assist a wounded Samaritan. We'd call that an impressive act of charity to aspire to, and we'd file it away and refer to it later. But there's more. That's actually not the story. You may remember that the original audience of this story considered Samaritans to be heretics because observant believers were so concerned about religious purity. The region of Samaria had been inhabited for several hundred years by mixed remnants of northern tribes who worshiped God with different rituals, different language than the Jews practiced in the south. So the Samaritans were despised by them as a mongrel people whose women were cast as harlots. They called them half-breeds, and they thought that they were a threat to their way of life. And Jews had little or no social contact with them. And then Jesus comes along and dismisses this prejudice altogether. But we can miss the importance of this story because that consciousness about Samaritan is lost on us. We say, good Samaritan, good story, I'm going to be nice to my neighbor, right? In fact, Jesus does something outrageous to his listeners. The internal structure of the story and its historical setting challenges the hearer to put together two unlikely and contradictory words for the same person, enemy and neighbor. According to John Dominic Crossan, the whole thrust of the story demands that one say what cannot be said, good Samaritan. It's unsayable. It's impossible. Samaritan as savior? The point of the story, then, is not just that one should help the neighbor in need. It's that our whole world view is being turned upside down. What was thought to be bad, Samaritan, is good, neighbor, and vice versa. The parable is memorable not because a Jew loves his enemy, but because the Samaritan, regarded as an enemy, loves a Jew. The tension in the story is that somebody that I don't want to help me, that I think is an other, that I have dismissed altogether, is the one who comes to save me. And my work is to accept that help. Who's in the ditch in the parable? Who needs help? It's the hearers of the story. And who's that? It's us. Without our noticing it until it's too late, the storyteller has the audience identify with the victim because he knows we won't see ourselves in the enemy. The average Jew couldn't see him or herself in the Samaritan. So I wonder, who is that for you? Who is the last person you think could do something for you? The sister you haven't spoken to for years? The parents you dismissed decades ago? Your noisy neighbor? The guy who cut you off in traffic on the way to church this morning? The nerd back in school in your chemistry class? Maybe it's the young man with the squeegee who could never match what you have in material wealth. Or the ex-con that you're frustrated with because he can't seem to hold a job. Or the immigrant who was just born on the wrong side of the Rio Grande. Maybe it's a woman. Who do you have a hard time helping you? Maybe it's a fraternity boy. Maybe it's the chairman of the board. Maybe it's someone you've hurt or ostracized or pigeonholed. Who or what is it that saves you? Do you see that in some way or another, you're in a ditch, you and me and our systems? And can you let the unlikely one come near and help? Let yourself be a wounded survivor who still needs assistance because we all do. And let the one who you think has nothing to offer, offer you something. Because we're the ones who limit the so-called enemy from having gifts that can help. And since that's true, since we built that wall, then we're the ones who can tear down that wall and say, I can be in contact, in touch, in love with even my enemy, and let that one touch me. And when we believe that the enemy, the other, has bathed the wounds of the man in the story, who is us, then the parable will begin to accomplish its healing transformation. You see, to fully understand this story, I believe, is to see Christ and ourselves as both the Good Samaritan and as the wounded fellow. If we're honest, I think we all begin this story expecting to play the role of the hero. Who doesn't, right? But if we let ourselves, we also play the role of the one who's been hurt, being taken care of by someone that we would never expect. And depending on who you are and on the road that you've traveled, identifying with the one or the other may be especially difficult. Why, my asking you to identify with the victim or identify with the enemy, you may think I'm crazy. But don't let the challenge of Jesus' parable obscure the promise that it betokens. All of us are in need of a neighbor who helps us to be whole. And each of us, whatever the world or your trauma or your old tapes may say, has gifts and strengths to conquer. There's good news in both of that. Jesus proposes a whole new world in which the walls between us and them no longer exist. The strong and the weak, the haves and the have-nots, the neighbor and the enemy coming to the aid of each other, to the aid of each other, and that is a two-way street. It only works if it goes in both directions. Harold Kushner, the author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, which many of you probably know, tells this story. A few years ago, he says, when I was traveling around the country discussing my new book, Who Needs God, I began to notice something very interesting. In virtually every radio and television studio I visited after I'd spoken about the benefits of being religious, someone, an interviewer, a producer, a camera operator, would take me aside and tell me privately that the most inspiring religious experience he or she had undergone happened not in the sanctuary, but in the basement, at an AA gathering or a meeting of some other 12-step program or its like. There was something authentically religious that happened to them there. So Kushner said, I asked them if they could identify for me what it was that was so helpful. And the notion that kept coming up was acceptance, proximity, nearness. You see, the message that they heard at the Friday night Sabbath or the Sunday morning service was about the things that they'd done wrong, separating them from God and their neighbor. But the message that they got from the Wednesday night 12-step meeting was, I'm not okay, and you're not okay, but that's okay. Because it goes on to say, take yourself on. Make amends. Keep coming back, and nothing you can do can separate you from the love of God. And if you'll live in that reality, then your essential self and your relationships with the people around you and your relationship with God will heal. He said, a woman told me of going to a support group for compulsive eaters and confessing to fishing food out of the garbage after her family had gone to bed. Instead of telling her, that's sick and you've got a real problem, the other group members responded, yes, Jay, we've done that too. And we know how terrible we feel when we do that. It's always going to be a struggle, they said. But you can grow in yourself and in a community and in God. You see, the groups offered the shared honesty of mutual vulnerability, openly voiced, the redeeming knowledge that other people, nice, honorable, appealing people, were struggling with the same demons that they were. And that you could do for each other what you hadn't been able to do for yourself. So welcome to the side of the road. Welcome to the ditch where life has flung us. Or to the church basement experience of acceptance now brought upstairs. All of us are in it because either we've been laid low ourselves, or we're willing to crawl in there in the ditch to help somebody else, and it's probably some of both. Welcome to a whole new world where true religion is not about believing the right things, but about acting with compassion, and where the neighbor is anyone and everyone who needs help. Amen.